It's the Popmatic Podcast for December 3rd, 2014. It's what you've all been waiting for.
Christmas?
The best books of the year.
Oh, I like Christmas.
Ooh.
AKA your holiday gift guide.
Yeah, it's an award show. Dun, 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 dun,
dun, dun. The Poppies.
Welcome to the 2015 Poppies. I'm your host,
we'll
Mike.
Make you happy.
From these awards, you can derive.
Our reading habits.
There you go. Hook these books to your veins.
It's the Popmatic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. I'm Brian, and joining me today are...
Mike.
Amanda.
Jeremy.
Bill.
This kicks off our Best of the Year shows. We're going to dedicate one show each to books, music, and movies. This week is books. We're going to do our top three. Let's get right to it. So how this is going to work, we're all going to do our number three, and then we're all going to do our number two, and then we're all going to do a number one. In fairness, we're just going to go in alphabetical order. So Amanda,
woohoo!
Your number three best book of the year.
Okay, so I downloaded several ebooks onto my Kindle when I went to go on my honeymoon in Italy. And I know, who reads on their honeymoon? But we did spend a lot of time on trains, so that's my excuse. And this is one that I not only got through, but I enjoyed it because in an alternative universe, Naya Vardalos and I are totes besties, like for sure. So I'm going to talk about her book, Instant Mom. I don't know exactly when this came out. It's been out for a while. It's not completely new. But it's about her struggles adopting a child, which I didn't know that she was even trying to do that. But along the way, you also get background information on My Big Fat Greek Wedding, and she talks about her acting and writing career and how that fits into her new life as a mom. And I really didn't realize that she had written as many films as she had. The only one I knew about besides My Big Fat Greek Wedding was Connie and Carla, which I absolutely love because it's got drag queens and show tunes, which is the best combination since peanut butter and jelly. Vardalos uses her trademark sarcastic and self-deprecating voice in her writing to describe her problems, both with her career and with motherhood, which manages to add comic relief without cheapening her situation. Also, just a fun fact, her husband is John Corbett's best friend in the Big Fat Greek movie, and I did not know that until later. So that was Instant Mom by Naya Vardalos, my number three book for 2014.
I should say, I forgot to say, these are books that we experienced in 2014. I think people that use the library a lot, sometimes they read the stuff when they want to read it, not necessarily when, as you would say, they tell you to read it.
That's right.
You read,
yeah.
You
read they.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, okay,
Mr. Bill.
My third book is The Good Nurse, A True Story of Medicine, Madness, and Murder by Charles Graber. It's quite disturbing. It deals with a registered nurse, Charlie Cullen, who was implicated with the deaths as many as 300 patients. If you think that's disturbing, wait till you read that the hospital bureaucracy enabled him to continue killing. The book is shocking and disturbing, but don't let that stop you. It's just amazing. Once you start to read it, it's like, they let him get away with this. They let him get away with this. So anyway, I highly recommend The Good Nurse. Brian, what's your third?
I just want to say that sometimes like truth is stranger than fiction, right? And
right.
That's a good segue to my number three, which is A House in the Sky by Amanda Lindhout. This was actually one of my book club picks, and I was really surprised. I didn't think that I would like it. I thought it was one of these paint-by-the-numbers memoirs about overcoming a tragedy. And the tragedy was that she and one of her friends was actually kidnapped by Islamic militants in Somalia and held captive. But eventually she was released. What I really liked about it was the first half was a memoir about her life and how she became a journalist. She came to journalism in an untraditional way. Like, she didn't go to college and sort of do it the way that you would typically do it. She sort of had made her own career. And, of course, she also was very naive and made mistakes and ended up being kidnapped in Somalia. It's an amazing book, and it actually really set my book club on fire. We actually talked about it for two book clubs in a row. Like, we read the next book, but then when we met to talk about the next book, we ended up talking about A House in the Sky again. Of course, one of the reasons was that some videotapes had been released about people who had been kidnapped, you know, who actually were killed. And that's actually one of the things that happened to her, is they threatened to kill her and they videotaped it and then sent the videos to her family. It's like, it's insane. And the book made me cry on the bus. So it was really good. And I would say that it's everything I wanted from Wild by Cheryl Strayed, but I didn't get. Like this really transformative spiritual experience, but going through something hard. With the caveat that in Wild, you know, her journey that she goes on is one that she chose to do herself. And I think that is a completely different light as opposed to like a crime being committed against you. But it was like way, way better than I ever thought it would be. A House in the Sky by Amanda Lindhout, and also very timely. Jeremy!
So my third book is also a memoir, the decidedly different subject. It's a comic book or a graphic memoir called Tomboy by Liz Prince. She's an artist that I first encountered when I lived in New Mexico in the first half of the 2000 decade.
The aughts.
Thank you. In the aughts. She's actually, she grew up in Santa Fe where my wife grew up. And they actually ended up, they went to the same weird hippie high school just at different times. And so I bought some of her mini comics there when I lived in Santa Fe, and also her first book called Will You Still Love Me If I Wet the Bed. And that book was just sort of a like a collection of gag cartoons almost about a relationship with a boyfriend that she had. And there was a through line of their relationship, but it really was just sort of four panel strips and stuff. This is a much longer work and is about her growing up and her lifelong sort of pursuit to dress, act like a boy, but what does that mean? So it's sort of about her struggle about fitting in and, you know, being a woman who happens to look like a boy, and I'm making quotation mark fingers, and dress like a boy, quotation mark fingers. It's really funny and really touching. I really liked it a lot. So that is Tomboy by Liz Prince. Mike?
So for my number three, I decided to talk about what I like to call an in-betweener kind of book, something light that I'd read between other books, hence the name in-betweener. Usually that involves like graphic novels or single-volume encyclopedias or dictionaries, that sort of thing, because I'm a boring guy. And this year I thought my favorite in-betweener was East of West, a graphic novel series, specifically Volume 2, written by Jonathan Hickman and drawn by Nick Dragota. It really sounds like one of those kind of things where, like, they asked me what I thought was cool and decided to make a comic book about it, which is kind of awesome. You know, sometimes you get, like, some sort of pop culture where it's like, you know, it just feels like it speaks to you. Basically, it tells the story of Death from the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse wandering a far future United States, Western United States, that's been kind of ripped apart by, like, this comet landed during, or asteroid landed during the Civil War, and basically split the United States into, like, seven different nations. And he's, like, wandering around what's left of the continental United States looking for his child, who's rumored to be the beast of the Book of Revelation. It is really awesome. It's by the guys who did the Manhattan Projects, which I recommended before on here. And it also has a kind of a similar disregard for actual history.
That's called alternate history.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. You know,
disregard for history.
Well, you know, I don't think Chairman Mao was a very religious guy yet in this universe. He came to the United States and founded a religion.
Oh, right. I read the first volume. I would really like it. I haven't read the second one.
It's good stuff. Carries on the awesome tradition. I even actually bought the third volume and decided to buy the rest of them. I don't really buy comics. East of West. Good times. What do you got, Amanda? For
all
number
right.
two.
So this is, yeah, now we're up to round two.
Yeah, number two. Dun, dun,
dun, dun, dun, fabulous dun, book reading. Dun, 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 dun. Excellent theme music. Okay, so at the beginning of the summer, my number two book was just sitting on my hold shelf when I went to pick it up. And since it was about food, I actually read it instead of just putting it on the bottom of the pile and forgetting about it till it's overdue. Even though I'd never read anything by her, Ruth Reichel has been popular for years as a nonfiction food writer. But with her latest book, Delicious, she enters the wonderful world of fiction. And this is the one book I read that actually did come out in 2014, so this one's really recent. Set in New York City, Reichel's book follows Billy, our heroine, as she begins her journalistic career at Delicious, the most prominent food magazine of the day. Now, being a Midwestern girl myself, I have to admit that New York has always kind of intimidated me, but the first part of this book made me wish I lived there, just like Billy, because it gave the city this really cozy, homey feel. The second portion of the book, which kind of feels like it shouldn't work, but it really does, begins a treasure hunt through old letters in the Delicious office written from a young girl named Lulu to James Beard, the, you know, king of cooking, as he worked for Delicious during World War II. And there's also a little bit of romance to spice things up if the food portion gets boring and you're like, I don't want to read about James Beard in World War II. Well, there's romance in there with Billy and an unnamed gentleman. I won't spoil it for you. And this is an excellent read that even my grandmother would love. So, Delicious by Ruth Reichel.
I think James Beard needs to put King of Cooking on his CV. That should be like, I'm James Beard, I'm the King of Cooking.
Kneel before me, kiss my ring. Guy Fieri is the pretender to the throne.
Mario Batali Schmatali, you know? Yeah. James Beard. All right, Mr. Bill.
My second book is a graphic novel called The Harlem Hellfighters by Max Brooks of World War Z fame and the Zombie Survival Guide. The book is illustrated by Kanan White. It deals with the 369th Infantry Regiment who fought the Germans in the trenches of France during World War I. It tells the tale of African-American soldiers that you've never heard of, and now it would be an excellent time to get acquainted with them. It has an excellent mix of historical accuracy and excellent storytelling. Also, Kanan White's black and white illustrations are quite evocative. Brian, what's your number two?
My number two is Hill William by Scott McClanahan, with the caveat that my pick is actually just Mr. McClanahan's total oeuvre, not just Hill William, which Hill William actually came out in 2013, but the library got it in 2014, and that's when I read it. It's definitely a companion piece to his book Crapalacha, which is a very poetic memoir about growing up in small coal mining towns in West Virginia. This style is like from the hip, punk, prose poetry about growing up in Appalachia. Crapalacha was about his grandmother and his uncle who had cerebral palsy, and they lived together. And Hill William is basically all the other people in the town and stories about them. There definitely are companion pieces. They actually use some of the same lines. Like I said, these are poetry chat books as much as they are novels. And they actually use some of the same lines of poetry in both books. And the central metaphor is that as a child and as an adolescent, McClanahan can't figure out if the mountains that he's living on and his family live and work inside, in many cases, are they pregnant with life, or are they a graveyard filled with bodies and pain and suffering? Why his entire oeuvre, not just these books, is because he runs this sort of production company, press, record label thing called Holler Presents. He does surrealist short films and book trailers. If you read Crapalacha and then watch the trailer for it on the Holler Presents website, you will cry, but I'm easy. This has been established. I cry real easy. He has a band called the Holler Boys, where they do sort of punk folk music. They've had at least one 7-inch released by Fat Possum Records. And for a while, you actually could get Hill William and the Holler Boys 7-inch like together as a package, like from Fat Possum Records. He is the author that I said was part of on the same press as some of those bizarro fiction freak out gross out labels. And the press that you were speaking of was Eraserhead Press, I believe. Yeah. But he's not on Eraserhead Press, but he's on Lazy Fascist Press, which is sort of like, if
it's a better name.
Well, yeah, if
Eraserhead Press is the genre bizarro fiction press, then Lazy Fascist Press is the literary genre.
Oh,
is the literary bizarro fiction press.
Sorry.
And none of that, but his Twitter account is bizarre and surreal. And also, he's married to another small press indie writer, Juliet Escoria. And like, they both have blogs, and their blogs and their books and their world and their online presence is where my head has been for a lot of 2014. The oeuvre of Scott McClanahan, he was at the Southern Festival of Books, and at C-SPAN you can still see the talk, quote unquote, he gave here at the library. Amazing stuff. That's my number two. Jeremy.
My number two is another comic book, because that's mostly what I read. I didn't have a lot of interactions with fiction from 2014 that I enjoyed, but this is a biography of a well-known figure. It's Andre the Giant, Life and Legend by Box Brown. Box Brown is a comics maker who's very prolific. He was actually at this year's Southern Festival of Books, too. He's the co-publisher of a company called Retrofit Comics, and they are, quote, dedicated to publishing and distributing floppy alt comics. And actually subscribe to their 2014 output. And it doesn't come very regularly, but I'll get a couple of comics every month that are weird and funny and just smart and nice looking comics. And the same craft and care that goes into curating their diverse line went into the biography of this beloved wrestling legend. And if you know, I mean, I think if you are 30 years old or older, you know who Andre the Giant was. And he was a legend whether you watch wrestling or not, because he was also in The Princess Bride. And so, I mean, I think his career touched the hearts of many, many people. And the book is pretty much a straight biography, but it's not like he was born, then he died. It's a really good story, well told.
I read this one. It's very anecdotal.
Yeah.
Like a lot of, like, he did a lot of interviews with his friends.
Mm-hmm. I actually thought it was going to be more like that, as I said, because it starts with, like, an interview with Hulk Hogan or whatever.
I believe so.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And I was thinking that it was going to be, like, other people telling the story, but it wasn't. But it's really sad and sweet, and I think that's kind of one of the things about Andre the Giant that I think you kind of come away with, whether you know his story very well or not. I really enjoyed it. Mike?
So my number two nonfiction book that I read this year, and I get to be all frowny face because this one's true life nonfiction. Number two for me is The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap by Matt Taibbi, which basically talks about, basically, Eric Holder decided when he became Attorney General that the businesses that brought about the economic downturn a couple of years ago, that they'd only, like, give them this teeny tiny fine, because, and that way that the government wouldn't look bad. If they went through, like, a really long, drawn-out trial, the government may actually lose, and that would look bad. So they decide, hey, we'll just give them a teeny tiny fine, you know, and we both walk away happy, and the government looks good. And meanwhile, metaphorically, on the other side of town, quotas for the police are going so high that they basically just kind of arrest black people who are just walking on the street and say that, oh, well, you know, you were obstructing foot traffic, and arrest them and bring them downtown. Horror stories about people just trying to, like, walk into their apartment building, and it's like, hey, you know, you didn't walk through the door fast enough or something, you know, just crazy. Just arrest them, bring them downtown, they pay a teeny tiny fine, again, you know, $20 or something, and the government looks good because, hey, you know, we're fighting crime. You only get to pay $20. How bad could it be? But it's like, you know, you've been arrested. You've got that permanent record. It just sounds awful. Anyway, so what's your number one pick?
Oh, we made it. They had to sit through 10 books that we really like to get to the ones that we love. My number one pick is Garlic and Sapphires, also by Ruth Reichel, because after reading such a good book as Delicious, I was curious because everybody was talking about what a great food writer she was. And so I just happened to find this one on the shelf, and I thought, that's the same chick that wrote Delicious. I want to read this. So the premise of this one is Reichel gets hired. She's the food critic in L.A., and then she gets hired to be the New York Times food critic, which is a fairly high seat in the world of food critic land. But obviously she can't go to restaurants as herself because the restaurant would totally cater to her and give her the best of everything, like the best service, the best menu options, the biggest raspberries. It really happened. They measured. I don't know why they measured, but apparently there was, she went as the other lady and they were small and she went as herself and then got big. So I don't know. So what she did was she decided to start dressing up into costumes and invented these characters to go out and have dinner, usually with friends or an acquaintance. So she wasn't usually alone. The first time she did it, she went out as her mother, who had passed away by that point. Another time, she takes on the persona of a little old lady she saw on the street one day and kind of stalked and followed home so she could kind of... It's a little creepy, but each character really embarks on a different adventure. Sometimes they're amusing. Sometimes she's just a nightmare. You know, one of those ladies at the restaurant that sends everything back and just, you know, everything has to be perfect. This really was an excellent book. I didn't want it to end. I wanted to keep reading about her adventures. She had also written Tender at the Bone and Comfort Me with Apples, which chronologically come before Garlic and Sapphires. I didn't think they were as good. Now, maybe that's because I read them in the wrong order, which is kind of like reading the punchline of a joke and then getting the setup. Because it's a lot. She puts a lot of her life into it, too, so I already knew what had happened as she's, you know, trying to get the job at LA Times. I already knew she had it and gone to New York. But they were all very good. And they had excellent recipes in them. I've made two of them. Her roast chicken was good. It needed a little work, I think. And I didn't make it exactly like the recipe because I don't like lemon. But I also made her New York cheesecake, which was very nice. Excellent recipes. Excellent book. Garlic and Sapphires. If you need a laugh, it's funny, it's poignant, and there's good food to eat.
I admire that you chose the same author for number two and number one. I'm saying, if you're listening, you should take that into account, listeners.
Yeah.
Bill.
My numero uno book, I want to recommend is a psychological thriller called Shatter by Michael Robotham. The book deals with a clinical psychologist, Joseph Lachlan, who is called to a suspension bridge because a nude woman with a cell phone is threatening to commit suicide. The woman commits suicide, and later the woman's daughter shows up at Lachlan's house to say her mother would never commit suicide because she was scared of heights. The plot thickens. This novel is part of a series with clinical psychologist Joseph Lachlan. As a matter of fact, this is like the middle one, but I wouldn't let that stop you. I'm planning to read more of this series because I truly did enjoy it. So I just want to recommend Shatter by Michael Robotham. It's a page-turner. Brian, what's your numero uno?
So surprisingly, was that the first piece of like sort of true genre work that we've mentioned so far?
So far, I think.
Okay, my number one of the year, and I think I might have teased this a few episodes ago, but Wolf in White Van by John Darnell. It's this really short, tight novel about an adolescent that disfigures his face in a suicide attempt and then creates a play-by-mail role-playing game. What is there not to like? I actually realized that what I really want from a good book is I want someone to rip out my heart and stomp on it. That's really what I want. And this book does that really slowly for how short it is. And I just, this is perfect. I've talked about it before, about its portrayal of gaming, both good and bad aspects of its portrayal of gaming. But the one thing that it is definitely explicitly about, and Jesse probably very skillfully left this out of his video review that he did for the library, but it's about gun control. It's about personal responsibility. It's about personal responsibility about guns, personal responsibility about art, both, you know, the rights and responsibilities of gun sellers, gun owners, artists, and the people that consume art. Goes into some really deep moral territory. Doesn't necessarily give you any answers, but just makes you think a lot. This is a lot more subtle, but I think it's also about childhood behavior and autism spectrum disorders and whether or not like certain behaviors, like normal childhood behaviors, if you applied a diagnosis to them, they might be considered autism spectrum disorders or not. Because just as all these moral ambiguities, there's these ambiguities about the psychology of the main character before he actually shoots himself. What was going on in his head? That was maybe one of the big questions of the novel that the reader is left with. Wolf in White Van by John Darnell. It also has the best cover of the year. Really good stuff.
It is a good cover.
Jeremy.
Well, so like I said, I didn't have a lot of 2014 fiction interaction, at least nothing from 2014. But I think the best book that I read this year was Blake J. Harris's Console Wars, Sega, Nintendo, and the Battle That Defined a Generation. Now, I was never a big video game person. I did own a Sega Genesis.
Get
out. I owned a Sega Genesis. And
did you play Sonic?
I played the heck out of some Sonic and Sonic 2.
Okay.
As late as 2002, I was at parties screaming Mortal Kombat because that's just the thing that I do. So this book is the inside story of the marketing, promotion, and sheer determination that went into making people of a certain age go 16-bit crazy in the early 90s. And it's about the CEO of Sega, Tom Kalinske, and him coming into the company to bring it out of the dumps, basically, and to try to overtake Nintendo. They were the first to market with the 16-bit system, and they plowed ahead and slowly whittled away at Sega's market share. The book is written basically like a novel. It's not reportage, but it's written more like a novel than it is just your sort of straight nonfiction book. As a result, it's much more immersive than the typical sort of cultural history. Maybe it's just me because I feel like patient zero in this outbreak, but it seems like there's an outbreak of 90s nostalgia going on right now. It never stoops down to the level of, gee, wouldn't it be nice to be a kid again? It just sort of is telling the story, and it's a lot more interesting than maybe I'm making it sound, and also than maybe you would think a book about what is essentially about marketing would be. It's very entertaining, and it's also really amazing because, you know, we're 20-plus years removed from the events in the book. The evolution of gaming the video game industry from Nintendo being super dominant in the late 80s and early 90s to where Sega rose and then fell
and then where we are now. Like, really, that sort of evolution was just a really small window of time. The advances in that industry are really incredible. And also, on sort of a different tangent, I've been reading a lot of comics from this era, individual issues. Every issue is blanketed with ads for video games. And sort of, it's sort of interesting to see some of the things that they talk about, the ads and marketing ploys in play in the actual context that they were originally presented.
Yeah, a lot of Super Graphic 16.
Yeah.
Bonk's Adventure.
Yeah, Bonk's Adventure. Absolutely. Yeah.
I remember seeing that in comics as at that age. Yeah. And I also like to say Sega does what Nintendo don't.
Yep.
And yeah, if you ask, you know, I listen to a lot of video game podcasts. And yeah, that's when you ask somebody of a certain age, they're like, so did you have a Super Nintendo or a Sega Genesis?
I don't remember it being as it was pretty heated.
Like, yeah, you had one or the other, and it was a partisan, you know.
Absolutely.
And it kind of extends to this day. I mean, you know, people, yeah, it's like, I have a PlayStation 4. I have an Xbox One. I'll cut you. You know, your console's not as good as mine. And rah, rah, rah. And
my wife,
basically the same thing.
My wife, who has probably not played a video game in 20 plus years, I said, I am reading this book about Sega. And she goes, Sega sucks. I was like, what are you talking about? Now, I love the Sonic the Hedgehog games. Amazing games. But I also love the Mario games, too.
Can we talk about opera some more?
They need to make a Mario opera.
I found some book that
is a Super Mario opera, I think.
Nice!
There was one, I remember I followed it on MySpace just to see how old that was. I was like, I totally see them. Wow, there actually was one.
Is that from the makers of the Anna Nicole opera?
This was like, so it was very low budge, you know, kind of, you know, 10 people in L.A. rented a space. Yeah. Wow. Anyway, my number one pick for last year, was a genre pick.
Genre.
The Martian by Andy Weir. It's basically like Gravity in a way. Like the very first manned mission to Mars, there's this disaster happens, and most of the party escapes except for one guy who's like left behind. They think he's dead, but he's still alive. And he's left alone on Mars, trapped, you know, and he has to figure out ways to survive. And it's very kind of hard science. He tries to use what was left behind. He creates a new biome, and he finds these plants. And luckily, he was a biologist / engineer. So he can build what he needs and grow what he needs. And it's very, like, edge of your seat kind of, because every now and then, suddenly something really bad happens. Like, oh, no, I accidentally set the entire biome on fire. This is bad. You know, and it's really, really funny. Like, eventually he gets to talk back to Mission Control. He finds a way that he hacks one of the old Mars rovers and talks to them. And the second transmission is one of the funniest things I've read in, like, maybe 10 years. I had tears in my eyes. Luckily, I was alone and not on the bus that time. I still remember laughing at a Terry Pratchett book on the bus once, and like 10 heads turned around and looked at me very angrily. What are you laughing at?
I'm laughing at you. What you gonna do?
That's right, man.
Take your pink plaid pants and get out of here.
That's right. Anyway, yeah, it's a really good sci-fi. It was very suspenseful, and you hope that he gets away, and he's a really funny dude. And it's one of those kind of books where I read it in like two sittings. I meant to read a couple pages one night and read the last 200 pages. It's a very short book. Good times. The Martian by Andy Weir.
You know that's Ridley Scott's next film.
Ooh,
Matt Damon.
I heard that it was optioned for a movie.
All-star cast. Yeah,
cool.
I mean,
that could be really
good. It's happening.
Wow, yeah. It was supposed to be another one of those kind of indie success story things, because he self-published it, and then, you know, a big publisher bought it, and then it got optioned for a movie. And
tickling my fancy are my runners-up that I didn't mention. One is Hild by Nicola Griffith. You guys might remember I went into nerd spasms about this book.
I wanted to read that.
I didn't put it on my best of the year list because the whole time I was thinking, if you weren't a total dweeb about medieval British history and languages, this book would be really confusing and hard for you. So I'm just like, this is not a book for everybody. The other book that I kind of talked about that I loved this year was the John Waters book. Now I'm brain fart.
Carsick.
Thank you. It was so funny. I was listening to the playaway in bed and I couldn't fall asleep. Because I was like laughing so hard, prevented me from going to sleep. I was laughing so hard.
I read that book. I liked his best case scenario because the book was in three parts. He took a road trip across America, and it was two fiction parts: the best case scenario, worst case scenario, and then what really happened. I thought his what really happened and the best case were really good. But I thought the worst case scenario was not good really at all. Like it was sort of like his worst impulses sort of just like set free, you know, gross for the sake of gross. But it was absolutely hilarious too.
You're right. What's tickling your fancy this week?
Sorry.
On the spot.
Well, my runners-up, I read plenty of novels and listened to a lot of audiobooks this year, but nothing from this year. I read several books by Lawrence Block that I really like in audio format, but there's some comics, because I read a lot of comics. A lot of the comics that I read this year that I really enjoyed included Bumperhead by Gilbert Hernandez, and also The Love Bunglers by his brother Jaime Hernandez. These guys do Love and Rockets, and they apparently can do no wrong, because every time I read something by them, it's pretty amazing. I really enjoyed the second volume of Ed Pisker's History of Hip-Hop, Hip-Hop Family Tree. Really cool. I discovered the first two volumes of Greg Rucka and Michael Lark's Lazarus.
Really, Lazarus.
Have you read
good.
That?
Okay. Yeah.
I was going to say, it's not on the same page as East of West, but I really liked it a lot. And also, I was talking about Sega and reading comics from the early 90s. I read the first 25 issues of Moon Knight, which was like volume 2 or 3 started in 89 or 90. And I really enjoy the character Moon Knight. I'm sure there might be a movie about him if Marvel will put
that would be amazing.
Yeah, if Marvel was going to put a raccoon with a machine gun in a movie, they probably will do a Moon Knight movie.
Why not?
Yeah, and he's awesome, and he's an interesting character. He was a mercenary.
That doesn't sell tickets, man. Interesting characters film festival. The multiplex is for raccoons and machine guns.
Hey, man, they're going there next. They're going to make an art film. It's going to be Mirror, Father Mirror. Anyway, I also read the newest volume of Moon Knight, written by Warren Ellis and illustrated by Declan Shalvey. And it was called Moon Knight from the Dead. It was a good take on the character. I've not read a lot of Warren Ellis's books. I know a lot of people swear by his works.
Anything you didn't read this year that you would have
Wow, man. Whoa.
Amanda, what's tickling your fancy this week?
Well, I didn't do honorable mentions because I've talked about most of the ones I want to talk about on either the podcast or our off-the-shelf blog, which you can check out online. So I wanted to talk about something completely different and talk about the TV show Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which stars Andy Samberg. And this is kind of his vehicle that after he left SNL, then this is where he went. It's set in the police department in Brooklyn. I kind of feel like I didn't watch this right away because I felt like this was sometimes Samberg can be so stupid. And I was like, this is just going to be dumb. I'm not going to watch this. So it came in on DVD. I'm like, okay, let's try it. It's fun because it's kind of like Gilligan's Island, but in a police station, except that Gilligan actually has some skills now. Like, he doesn't just break everything. You know, Samberg is obviously Gilligan, his detective. And so, like, he is completely immature and completely hilarious, but he still catches the bad guy. Like, the bad guy doesn't get away, and he doesn't burn down the police station and wreck the coconut radio. The other part I like about this is, like, the cast people all on the show, I don't know any of them, but, like, their faces all look familiar. Like, that's that guy. What was he in? So the one guy that I could figure out was that guy who's the old guy in the singing group in Pitch Perfect, and he's the nice guy in The Office. And I did look up his name, but I'm not going to tell you because it doesn't really matter. So if you've watched Pitch Perfect and you know where they have the old guy singing group, he's one of those guys, and then he's in this show and he's the nice guy. So I did think this was going to be stupid, but it was good. Right now the library has season 1 because season 2 is still on TV. It probably won't change your life, but you will enjoy 20 minutes of TV.
So I have an honorable mention and a movie. Honorable mention is a book that I really enjoyed called The Good, the Bad, and the Infernal. It's basically this kind of, yet again, another Western thing. It sounds kind of like East of West, but this is in prose. Basically, every 500 years a portal opens up somewhere in the world that will lead anybody who walks into it they'll be able to go into heaven. So a band of adventurers from around the world, there's a bunch of freaks, a murderous freak show. There's like this old man and this kid, and then there's these steampunk people in this steam-propelled car/train all converge into this like place in the West trying to get through the door before it closes. Hilarity ensues. Good stuff. The movie that I watched last weekend that I really liked is called The Rover, starring Guy Pearce and Robert Pattinson. It's a kind of post-apocalyptic movie. It's set 10 years after the collapse in Australia. It's very kind of like low budget, low key. You know, it feels a lot like the original Mad Max. That kind of like everything's kind of crappy. Basically, these criminals steal Guy Pierce's car and he gets mad. He wants his car back. So he kidnaps.
You say Red Rover, send my car right over.
Yeah. with more
Wouldn't
shooting.
That be easier?
It's one of those movies that got really mixed reviews. You know, it seems like the movies that get mixed reviews are the ones I like the most. Killing Them Softly, I loved.
That
you know,
usually means
or Under the Skin, or like, you know.
Oh,
so,
I liked Under the Skin.
Yeah, you know, get mixed reviews, I'm there. So this one got really mixed reviews. I was blown away. Guy Pearce reminds me a lot of kind of like 70s Clint Eastwood, very like, doesn't talk much. Angry sneer a lot. And Robert Pattinson, surprisingly, was really good. He was like a mentally challenged American guy who, you know, leads him to his brother who stole his car. Good stuff.
Corrections! These are mostly just nitpicks, maybe not corrections. I said Tony Atkins did some of the New 52 Wonder Woman books. It was actually Tony Akins. Okay. You casually dropped that you were in Provence and you heard a holiday song. Uh-huh. You meant Provence, the local coffee shop.
While I was vacationing in the south of France.
You played Jingle Bells.
Wonderful. Yeah,
that's true. I did go to Marseille last week, though. That's a different story.
I'm going to score some hair over there.
That's right.
I know the corpse of Princess Grace of Monaco. Oh,
yeah.
Because usually if you do go to Provence, France, it's because you don't want to hear, like, American pop songs. Right?
Yeah. I go there, I expect to hear Lady Marmalade.
All right. So, OCLC.
That joke went over well.
For ABN.
So OCLC, the huge library consortium that runs WorldCat, their full name is Online Computer Library Center Incorporated. Though they are a nonprofit, they've had a lot of criticism in the library community for being a monopoly.
Yes.
And not operating like a nonprofit organization. They're sort of the library equivalent of the NFL.
I can see that.
A very large, profitable nonprofit that everybody uses. With the risk of being attacked, Bill, stay over there on the other side of the table.
Uh-oh.
So the actor that plays the new Doctor Who is Peter Capaldi. I'm not going to say that you said his name wrong. I'm just going to let people listen and decide for themselves what it is that you said. Okay.
Ouch.
No, I listened carefully. I went online. I'm right.
Transcribed.
You could make a good argument that you said Capaldi.
Capaldi?
I think he said it wrong, but I wasn't paying attention.
I didn't know who it was, so I didn't know if he was right or wrong. I'm like, oh, that guy, sure.
Yeah, Peter, what's his face?
Yeah, Pete. Best buds.
Petey Caps.
For more information, you can go to www.library.nashville.org. And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
Frank Zappa. Oh, Adam Dean.
Also known as.
Yeah.
I've always wanted to say that.
Peaches and Regalia.
Next week. Next time.
The Frank Zappa of Nashville, Adam Dean. Next week, it will be our Best Music of the Year show, and perhaps there will be special guests.
Ooh.
I'm not saying
Cliff Burton?
I'm not saying the ghosts of Frank Zappa, Cliff Burton, or
Beethoven.
The person that used to be Prince. The real Prince won't be here.
Buster Douglas free, Super Monaco GP free, or Collins free. What Nintendo? Buy a 16-bit Genesis system between now and October 31st and get an extra game.